Join me, Dr. Cathy Weston, for my monthly podcast series, Get a Grip, where I try and unpick some of the trickier questions relating to how we raise children today. How do we talk to children about mental health? Where do we draw the line when it comes to screen time? Do children need both parents? Whose responsibility is the mental health education of our children, teachers or parents? These podcasts will get me talking and you thinking. I've reached out to today's thought leaders and main speakers in this area. I've asked them their views on the areas where we need to get a grip. An internationally respected face of child and adolescent mental health, Dr. Pooky Knight-Smith works tirelessly to be the change she wants to see. Prolific speaker, lecturer, trainer and author, she develops and shares practical evidence-informed approaches to promoting mental health, arming health and education staff with skills, information and the knowledge they need to support children in their care. Pooky has a PhD in child mental health from the Institute of Psychiatry, is the author of 7 books and was previously the chair of the Children and Young People's Mental Health Coalition. She's an autistic mum of 2 who works hard every day to win her own battles against post-traumatic stress disorder, anorexia, self-harm and depression. When she's not working, she's usually climbing or singing. Welcome, Pooky. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you, Cathy, in these very strange times, but thank you for having me.
Fantastic to have you. You and I overlap in so many different ways, but I think the one thing that draws us together is we're both passionate about children and young people thriving, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. And I do find myself recommending your work often, because I think the thing that we have in common, as you say, is just really having children and young people and those who work with and care for them at the heart of what we do and wanting to make sure that, yeah, they can flourish and enjoy themselves.
And the other thing that really is a commonality between us is our passion for evidence-based advice and resources. So, for example, when I meet parents who are concerned about or teachers concerned about a young person self-harming, I'll refer them to the book that you wrote, or schools who are interested in the best ways of creating a kind of an environment and a culture that supports positive mental health. You've written a book on that. So it seems like you've written a book for every scenario.
Do you know, it's one of the funny things. People often tell me how prolific I am, and yet I always feel like I'm being lazy. But yeah, you're right. That kind of having our feet in the evidence base, I think, is really important. But I also think it's really important that we make things feel accessible and doable. So I kind of pride myself really on trying to make simple what might look quite complex in terms of the research base and what works in clinical practice, and turning that into really, yeah, simple stuff that people can use every day, really.
And that's certainly something I know, and you know, educators are grateful for. They're very, very busy. GPs are grateful for. Parents are grateful for. So hopefully this podcast interview will give people some concrete things to think about and potentially to apply over the rest of the summer and into the new school term. Can we just reflect on what children and young people have been through? And I think you'll agree with me that it's not the case all children have suffered or, you know, have been disadvantaged. It's a very mixed bag. And some children indeed have been thriving during lockdown.
Absolutely. And I think it is really important that we remember that there is good as well as bad here. And there have been some real positives, and we need to celebrate those. We need to think about what have our children learnt during this time in the widest sense. We need to look at where relationships have become better. My daughters, so I have 2 10-year-old daughters, and they got on always quite well. But during lockdown, they've developed a real closeness that they never really had before. And I will often find in the morning that when I go to check in on them before I start work, that they're curled up together in one or other of their beds. And it's just because, you know, that things have really moved on for them. That said, of course, it's been a really difficult time for many people, and for many people, the picture has been somewhat mixed as well. So we know that, you know, there's been an increase in domestic abuse and violence. There's been massive issues with poverty, very high levels of anxiety and low mood and depression. And in many cases, people who perhaps hadn't experienced that before. So they're managing that for the first time and without the kind of support and input they might normally have. So there's lots that's going on that is tricky. And then there's that underlying current of fear and uncertainty, which is difficult for all of us. And we're not able to turn to the ways in which we might normally cope and manage because lots of those things have been shut off to us during the period of lockdown.
As you've commented, you know, loneliness, mental health issues, a lot of them are prevalent in people potentially who've never experienced them before. And one of the things I've noticed is that a lot of people are slightly more empathetic towards, you know, mental health, more interested in mental health in a way that they've never been before, because everybody had a little taste of what it felt like to suddenly, you know, have opportunities cut off or to be disconnected from those critical social connections. I think in some ways, there might be an argument that our sense of community has been emboldened through lockdown and that perhaps we do value being kind to one another a little bit more.
Absolutely. And I think, as you say, there is just that deeper sense of empathy that on a good day, and we're all having our good and our bad days, I think, but on a good day, that I think people are just a little bit more able to understand the struggles of friends, of colleagues, of peers, as a result of having felt some of those things. The people who I find at the minute who are struggling most are those who perhaps were quite outgoing and happy and have been generally well before, who might for the first time now be knowing what it feels like to be anxious, to feel cut off and lonely and uncertain and maybe quite low, just because they haven't had to develop the kind of methods for coping with that in the past. And so, yeah, they're the ones who are struggling a little bit more. The other thing I'm finding is that I'm autistic, and people are beginning to kind of understand that a lot more now as well, because I've had quite a lot of people comment to me saying, as they begin to start to go out into the world again a bit more, how anxious they feel talking to people and how they've lost their social skills and how they're having to second guess every situation and it all feels very complicated. And it's like, welcome to my life. That's my everyday. So there's a bit more empathy there as well, which I think is helpful, actually.
And the other thing, you know, because I'm a great follower of you on Twitter, I love your tweets. And one of the things that's very striking is that, as you say, you've already created both little daily methodologies for coping and bigger methodologies that many people would never have thought about cultivating for themselves. So, for example, you know, that lovely thing that you do every day, the three things that have gone well that are positive, you know, I think that is a very, very simple and effective tool for really teaching ourselves and our children to extract the good from what could have been a very challenging day. And it links, doesn't it, heavily to the sort of gratitude research and the power of gratitude in reframing challenging circumstances.
Absolutely. And that's where that idea came from. So three good things, which is a hashtag, which is relatively well used now on Twitter. And some people have taken it to other platforms as well. I started doing that a few years ago because I was lucky enough to see Marty Seligman speak. I was invited in by one of the big banks in Canary Wharf because I'd done some work with them previously, and they paid us £25,000 an hour to have him come talk to their staff. We're in the wrong profession. And I went and saw him speak, and he was really inspiring. And he's like the godfather of positive psychology, essentially. And he talked about this big experiment that they'd done years ago about gratitude journaling, essentially. And that they found that when people each day took time to check in with themselves and reflect on three things for which they were grateful and to write about those, that after a few weeks, that did have a significant impact on their mood. And that same impact was not seen in people who just did non-directed journaling. And the really interesting thing for me was that the effects of that experiment lasted well beyond the time for which people did the journaling. So it kind of changed their way of thinking a little bit, perhaps. But I liked it as an idea, and I was in a fairly tricky place myself at the time. And, you know, you're always kind of happy to try something new, I think, in those instances, if it might sort of help a little bit. And so I did a very simplified version of tweeting it each day. But for me, that's been really powerful because, well, a few things really. One is that it does make me stop and check in with myself every day and to look for the positives, even on the hard days. And actually, on the hardest days is when it makes the most difference. Doing it on Twitter also means there's a whole community of people. And I often get a lot of joy from seeing the little things that made other people happy too. And then finally, there's that sort of sense of community. And I do find that if I've not shared my three good things, I'll get people checking in with me. They'll kind of slide into my DMs and just go, "Are you okay? I've noticed that you've not tweeted this evening and just wanted to make sure you're all right." And there's just something really lovely about that. They're often people that I don't know, but who, you know, who follow and are aware of what I do and who do seem to really care. And that's really lovely.
And some of your lovely things, they stick with me. Like one of my favourites was hearing your daughter's attitude to doing a little bit of maths the other day. You know, she couldn't wait. I think it's terribly interesting to have, it's always interesting for people to have an insight into other people's family life. And I think some of those comments that you make on Twitter, they remind people of things that are important, and that it's exciting to see, you know, to see how other people cope and effectively.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing is that it makes you sort of remember the little things. And I do find that sometimes I will go back through, and I try quite often to share pictures. So the one you were referring to the other day when I said to Ellie, are you ready for your maths lesson? And she just stormed across the house in her roller boots going, yeah, I'm ready. And there's a picture of her on her roller boots, and I'll be able to look back on that in the future. And that's a moment that I enjoyed and was really precious, but that I would definitely just have forgotten otherwise. But it helps to anchor you in those little moments that really do matter. And yeah, I think sometimes it's really simple things. And when things are really hard, it can be just remembering that first sip of coffee in the morning, or the way that someone spoke to you with kindness, or the fact that someone gave way to you in traffic can be, you know, these little things can really pick you up. The interesting thing I found, I think it has genuinely impacted on how I think. So I had a very, you know, I've got a difficult head, hard stuff goes on in my head all the time. And I used to have a very sort of negative mindset much of the time. And I do find now, I think I'm sickeningly positive much of the time. And I do find that, you know, I get stuck in traffic, and instead of thinking, oh, I'm stuck in traffic, I'm thinking, fantastic, I can listen to my audiobook for a bit longer. It's interesting.
Well, so it's quite interesting. I agree. I mean, I'm a very positive person, and I don't know why I wake up in the morning full of enthusiasm for everything and very happy naturally. And one of the things I'm interested in getting your opinion on, and also in pulling out, because this is something I really believe, that if it doesn't come naturally to you to be sort of positive, and I mean in the general sense, it is absolutely something we can be proactive about. And I'm very interested in that component of resilience, which is about being proactive. You've mentioned being proactive when it comes to one's thinking, proactive when it comes to challenging negative self-talk or intrusive thoughts. Can you sort of comment a little bit more about that, and do you agree with me that ability to be proactive is exciting for everyone?
I think so, absolutely, and it's certainly a journey I've been on very much myself. I think it's something I was able to teach about before I was able to do it, if that makes sense. But yes, I think you can take steps to change how you think, how you feel, how you behave. And that's the kind of, you know, the very basis of kind of cognitive behavioral therapy, which is all about addressing our thoughts in order to then go on to address our behaviors and actions. But I think it's remarkable how, if you stick with it, even if you're not feeling it at the beginning, how over time things can really, really begin to change. One of the most helpful bits of advice I ever got was from, I had a very good therapist for many years, and he often used to just ask me, what's the evidence for that? So I'd hold all these entrenched views, some of which I'd carried for decades and I'd never spoken aloud before, but I'd just quietly held those judgments of self, or thinking about how others thought of me, or my view of my own work and that kind of thing. And he would, yeah, ask me to look for the evidence. And then we'd look for, well, what would be the contradictory evidence? And an example there would be, I am quite perfectionist and have very high standards. And if I run an event, for example, and then get feedback afterwards, I will tend to dismiss, or historically would tend to dismiss, the 99 glowing comments and really zone in on the one where it was only good. And I'd really wonder how I'd let that person down. And what I've learned to do over time is to think about, well, where might that person be coming from? And I've learned a lot about how hurt people, and thinking about those, you know, what might be going on for the other person. It's not always about you. But then also thinking about, and what about these 99 other people? Why is their point of view not relevant? And if their point of view is different than mine, if there's 99 of them and one of me, perhaps I need to listen. And so I think with a lot of what I teach, I guess the thing is that I've had to work through a lot of these things myself. And so I really, it comes from a place of really believing in it, I suppose, because these are skills and ideas that I'm using every day in order to kind of cope and thrive in my own life.
And I think it's important, you know, going back to empathy, you know, teaching our children to perhaps put themselves in the shoes of someone who's being mean to them, or who they don't, you know, being able to think a little bit more broadly and more flexibly about other people and their positions. One of the things you're making me think about that I'm always struck by is when a celebrity does anything online or, you know, is presented online, there are so much negativity that just pours out of people in response that it's no wonder that so many celebrities suffer from grave anxiety, because it's so anxiety inducing for any human being to have that vitriol, you know, thrown at them.
Absolutely. And I think it's hard when you feel that you're being examined. And also when people will tend to pick on, you know, if there's someone who are trying to make you feel down, which for some reason, some people do seem to do, they will often tend to pick on your biggest insecurities. And that can be incredibly challenging. And I think that that's true, not just of, you know, celebrity in the traditional sense, but anyone who begins to grow an audience. And it's something that I've had to be mindful of myself, and I'm sure you found the same as well, Kathy, that as your audience grows, then with it grows your tribe and those people who've got your back and are kind and caring and on side. But you'll also always have the haters and the critics, and it's about thinking how much airtime do you give them. And I try hard to think about it for myself as I would teach my daughters, which is, so they have a little YouTube channel, and mostly they get really nice kind of comments and feedback from people, and every now and then someone will just be remarkably mean for no apparent reason. And I've taught them, and I follow this myself, that if someone is kind, that's great, and we respond nicely. If someone gives us constructive criticism, actually we stop and we listen to that and we think, is there something I can learn here? But if someone is just being mean, we block, we delete, we mute, and we move on, because it's just not worth our time.
And I think that lesson that you've given your children in terms of digital hygiene is so important, because it feeds into digital resilience. And these children are going off to school, they're reading comments about that other people have made about their physical appearance, about themselves on WhatsApp, on social media apps. It's very difficult if they don't have that kind of that toolkit that you've given them as the parent for coping with what is inevitable negative feedback at some point.
Absolutely. And that's it. Kids can be cruel, and not just kids either, actually. And I think that's the interesting thing here. Like, as a parent, I found I've learned a lot about how to conduct myself by thinking about what are the lessons I would want to teach to my children and what kind of a role model do I want to be. And that's partly about, you know, what does healthy online relationships look like? But it's also things about, you know, am I actually present in the moment, or am I stuck to a device? And is my sleep being disrupted by my online habits? And, you know, it's very easy to put down lines in the sand for your children, but much harder to do it for yourself.
And I think what's interesting, I'm sure you've had this as well, people expect people like you and I to kind of have it sussed and, you know, to be, you know, remarkable in every way in terms of our own mental health and parenting. But people are always taken aback when I say that I try all the time to do a better job, to role model in a better way. Most days I don't get it right, but I'm always trying to work on it. And I think people forget that everything is a work in progress, and that we're always learning how to be a better role model to our children.
Absolutely. But do you find, Kathy, that people kind of connect more with you and your work when they realise that you are human and that you do make mistakes?
Absolutely. So in all of my talks, I, rightly or wrongly, will refer to my own parenting journey. I give concrete examples with my own children, you know, and where I've tried to apply or advice or failed in that mission. And the first thing you will see in the audience is relief. In fact, one of my first slides that I often show is a picture of my very messy kitchen. And I tell them that I'm not perfect, and that no one is, and that no one should expect anyone else to be perfect. And there is universal relief to that. And I think it's important in a world that can feel very inauthentic, that that authenticity is always welcome, I think.
Absolutely. And it's something I've been on quite a kind of journey on myself, because as you said before, you kindly referred to my books, and I wrote my first books a lot earlier on in this journey. And it was before I'd kind of, you know, I had a big relapse in my 30s and ended up hospitalized with anorexia and really, really unwell, and went through long periods of really struggling with self-harm and suicidal ideation. And it was a really tough time. And as I was kind of falling down that hole initially, I was putting on the brave face and acting perfect and trying really hard to be the person who I thought people needed to see. And actually becoming open and honest about my kind of living experience with things was hard, because I felt, well, surely this will undermine my credibility. You know, I wrote the book on self-harm and eating disorders, and here I am in hospital, unable to manage those issues for myself. But I found the opposite to be true. I found that since being more open and more honest, it's completely changed how I work, but in a really positive way, I think.
So in terms of, we know we're in August now and children are returning to school in a few weeks. Let's share, in the spirit of self-disclosure, let's share a little bit about what we've been doing as parents to prepare our own children psychologically for the move back.
Oh, that's a great thought. So my children went into lockdown earlier than most. I withdrew them from school early because we live with my mother-in-law, who was kind of high clinical risk. So my kids had not been with other children in the same room for many months. And one of the things I did do was, as a family, we decided that we would allow them to do one of their summer activities that we'd booked months and months ago. So they went to Stagecoach Week, which is kind of acting and drama and dance and that kind of thing. So they spent a week interacting with other kids there, which I think was really important, was really tricky for them. And there were lots of fallouts amongst the kids because I think they were all a bit out of practice. The other thing I'm thinking about really carefully at the moment is about routine and sleep in particular. I don't know about your household, but my household, sleep has been a very strange thing, particularly for my kids. They've slept at very strange and different times, and they certainly wouldn't be wanting to get up for the school run if we didn't address that. So we're getting back into a more normal routine with sleep. And we've also been thinking a little bit about just spending a little bit of time sitting down and, you know, like Ellie doing her maths the other day. This is because I don't want being back in the classroom to come as a complete shock to them. I don't want them to feel scared and anxious about that. So they're not doing loads and loads of work, but they're doing a little bit just to kind of get used to it again. And then finally, just helping them to connect with their friends online. So I've had to completely scrap all the rules that I had around social media and that kind of thing for my children because they're young, because otherwise they couldn't talk to their friends. So I've had to revisit that totally as a parent during lockdown. And they've spent a lot of time FaceTiming their friends and playing dolls and that kind of thing, so that hopefully those relationships are somewhat bridged before they return to school.
That's right. So, you know, we can both agree that, you know, helping your children to move back to school, it isn't something that waits until September, that really these last few weeks of August can be fundamental to easing that transition back. So like you, sleep, we both know, can have a dramatic impact on how children behave and learn in school. And I think sleep has been all over the place for many people over the last few months. And I think that they need to practice and have the expectation set that that sleep routine will revert to school term routine. Certainly we'll be putting that in place in the last week or so before school. I think for parents of older children, there's a great concern. You know, it's not easy for a 14-year-old like my son to get out of bed at 7 a.m. His body clock is telling him to sleep in till 10. So I think that there's a lot of work to do there to make sure that the sleep routine works. As you've also said, children have had a lot of access to digital technology for good reason, but there needs to be a gradual return to sort of expectations around what that relationship will look like during the school term. And I think I love and agree with, and also myself concur with, that, you know, children don't need to get rusty. We don't want their academic skills falling off a cliff, which is known as the summer slide. And a little bit of maths, a little bit of English, no matter what age their children are, I think is a fantastic idea. Even, I'm sure you would agree with me, even 25 minutes, 30 minutes a day is a fantastic input to be able to make sure children don't feel rusty picking up a pen, you know, when it comes to September.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it doesn't need to be kind of big, scary, deep stuff. I think my concern is more that they literally haven't been in a classroom since, I mean, early March now. And they have, my girls have had some online learning, and they've done some really fantastic work actually, and quite a lot's changed for them in the preceding months. but they just haven't been in a classroom situation. And so even if it's, you know, Ellie was sitting writing the other day about the day that she would meet Ariana Grande, and she really enjoyed doing that and it was fun for her, but it does mean that she has remembered how a pen feels in her hand and she has sat down and focused for 20 minutes on something that wasn't a screen. And these, you know, it doesn't need to be rocket science, I guess is what I'm saying. And I hope it will help a little bit, because my worry is that kind of lack of cognitive safety when kids arrive in school and they're just worried about being in the classroom and they're fearful of getting things wrong and they've forgotten how this all works, and actually just giving them a little bit of a boost so they go in thinking at least some of this is a bit more within their control, I think will really help.
And the truth of the matter is there isn't a teacher or a parent or a student that isn't a little bit nervous about the return to school. You know, every year I have a feeling, a pit of my stomach where I think, oh my gosh, how am I going to cope with all the school runs and two children in two different schools, and how am I going to get them there on time? There's so much to think about, but that's a very common feeling, isn't it?
100%. Actually, my most recent YouTube video was about imposter syndrome for teachers as we approach the return to school, because I've been asked about it so much. And it's a really common thing that as we look to return to school in September any year, that everybody thinks they've forgotten how to teach. They think they're not going to be able to do it. And they have that feeling in the pit of their stomach, as you say, about, ah, how am I going to do this? And every year, you know what, we manage. This year, it's harder than usual because A, many of us have been away for longer, and B, we're returning to something that looks quite different than what we left, and we might not really know how that is going to feel. And so we're having to kind of learn as we go, and there's still a lot of uncertainty. So there's lots there to be worried about. But the key thing here, I think, is that everyone's in the same boat. And the thing I found to be really helpful in my training is just saying to everyone, look, hopefully this will make you feel better. If you look around you, all those other people are feeling the same thing too. And they might be appearing like they're holding it together, but actually we all have the same worries and fears. So we just need to start talking about it and helping each other.
Now, in terms of children who do feel very anxious about the transition back to school, I'd love to just sort of share advice I normally give to parents and have you comment and sort of develop it, if that's okay.
Sure.
First of all, I always remind parents that parental mental health is highly correlated to children's, and it's not something parents are very aware of. And all I'm really saying is that you really, as counterintuitive as it is, parents really need to put their own mental health first to some degree and really think about how they can best manage their own worries and anxieties first. So can you kind of, what do you think about that?
I'd agree wholeheartedly. And I think that, you know, it's very difficult for us to be the adult that our child needs if we don't attend to our own needs first. And you can do it for a short period of time. You kind of run on adrenaline, but you soon get very, very tired. And we don't make good decisions when we're tired. It's very difficult to be supportive. And it's certainly difficult to be kind of calm and caring if we're emotionally or physically kind of run down and worn down ourselves. The other thing is that we are constant role models to the children in our care. And so they will watch, what are the things that we're doing to look after ourselves? How do we manage the ups and downs? What does that look like for us? And they learn more from that than anything we tell them to do.
I think it's very, very important. I'd love to hear your view on this, that we're connected and thinking about how our bodies, our physical bodies, are responding to anxiety, or feel it in our bodies, how it affects us, and teaching children how to navigate and interpret those feelings in our tummy, or that make our throat feel very dry, and what anxiety looks and feels like, and also how to kind of manage it rather than to avoid it.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. The kind of physiology of anxiety and understanding that and talking about it is crucial, because small children in particular, if they've not had these conversations before, it's quite scary. You know, if your heart starts beating really fast and you feel like you might be sick and your tummy's doing all sorts of funny things and you're sweating, that's quite, you know, you're not in control of that. And that feels horrible and scary and difficult. And if your parent says to you, oh, I feel like that sometimes too in these situations, and this is what I do about it, it's really reassuring to kind of normalize it. True for older kids too, but hopefully they've kind of understood that they're not entirely alone in it as they get a bit older. So very important to have those conversations. But then the next thing is that when we teach children and young people the skills that they need to kind of respond to and manage some of those difficult feelings and the physiology that comes with anxiety, it's like a superpower. You know, if you learn some kind of breathing or relaxation techniques that work for you, and you learn to recognize the warning signs in your body that you're beginning to get quite tense and anxious, and you're able to start to use one of those strategies, then actually feeling things physically change for yourself is, it's remarkable. I mean, it's a brilliant skill at any time in life, but when you first learn to do it, it's like a superpower. Really, really powerful stuff.
And I think, again, knowing that your parent, the person that you look up to most in the world, also experiences those things, but critically is sharing and modelling how they cope when that happens, that's the key, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think the other thing is about reassuring that it's okay that you feel like this, and thank you for talking to me about it. I had a lovely moment with one of my daughters the other day, who, it was coming up to bedtime, and she came to me and she said, "Mummy, I need you to help me because I feel far too excited and I know it's time for bed and I need to be calm, and you're good at that, aren't you?" And I feel, you know, she's kind of excited in not necessarily an entirely good way. So I said, "Okay, no, I can help you with that." And I thought, I'll teach her a new strategy. So I talked her through a kind of calming strategy. We did the kind of tensing all your muscles and then relaxing them, working up from her feet right through to her head and going through her body. And she sort of tensed and relaxed each bit. And then at the end, I sort of said to her, "How do you feel now, Trent?" "Now I'm ready for bed." And she said, "Mummy, you're a magician of happiness."
You know what? I remember that entire anecdote. I must spend all of my time reading your Twitter account. Gorgeous story. And it's so inspirational because you've proven that some of these evidence-based approaches are actually quite easy to apply.
They are. And the other thing is, if you learn a few of those tricks, you know, you learn a couple of breathing strategies and a couple of things that work for you as an adult, then if you teach them to your child, then when you do get those difficult moments when your child is angry or upset or anxious, then if you go to that kind of pre-prepared script, if you like, of this technique that you have, then it not only calms them, but it calms you as well. Because naturally, as parents, as carers, when our child becomes distressed, that's difficult for us as well. And we can't help but respond to that because we really deeply care. And what can happen if we don't have a kind of go-to strategy is sometimes that we find ourselves joining them in their distress. And that tends to make it worse for both of us rather than making it better. And there is a time for joining your child in their distress. You know, if you've suffered a loss, then it's okay to cry together and work through that. But sometimes what we need is just to reset things. And in those moments, if you can go to a strategy that you've learned, that you've practiced, and just do it together, then actually it buys you a bit of time, it calms you down, and together you can kind of co-regulate and then work out what do we do next.
That's right. It's so counterintuitive for parents to, you know, if your child is very distressed or upset, it is very, very distressing and very, very hard to stay calm and not to just fire solutions at them or fire of reassurances that will be ineffective at them as well.
And I think a thing that's important to remember in those moments is that when a child is deeply distressed in whatever way, if they're angry or sad or anxious, that they're not going to take on board anything that we say. Their brain is not functioning at this point. They're in kind of fight, flight, freeze type response. And our job right then is to reassure them and calm them down. And sometimes in order to do that, we have to go against our kind of gut response and we have to remind ourselves to just be the adult that our child needs in that moment. And sometimes if we're in a situation where there are other people there, we have to step outside thinking about what other people will think of us, because sometimes I think we can get hung up on how others will judge what we're doing rather than doing what's right for our child. And I've certainly been in this situation myself. So one of my daughters is adopted, and she, you know, like many children who've come through the care system, she doesn't always, you know, emotional regulation is challenging for her. And she's a remarkable child, but every now and then things are really tough for her and she can have those moments where things go completely awry. And in those moments, what she needs more than anything is a cuddle. But if we are out in public and she's suddenly having a tantrum and I go and I give her a cuddle and I hold her and I shush her and I calm her and I'm really kind to her, that's what she needs, but it's not what maybe other people would be expecting. You know, they'd be expecting a reprimand or some other response to that behaviour, but it's not what she needs in that moment. And of course, we'll always revisit that later and find out what was going on and how we might have dealt with it differently. But yeah, I try to be the adult that she needs in those moments rather than the adult that I want other people to see, if that makes sense.
It certainly does. And it takes a lot of parental confidence to do that and to always do what's best. You know, I always say to my son when he says, "But mummy, my friends have this and that," or, you know, I didn't buy him a phone until he was 13 and a half. And, you know, I always say to him, I will always do what's best for you, not what any, you know, I won't copy what other people are doing. And I think in some ways, I think children are very appreciative of that stance.
I think that's right. And I think having a family where nothing is off limits in terms of conversations and children can ask questions, and that if things go wrong for them or they do something wrong, that they can come and they can tell you, knowing that you will listen first and help them first. And then, you know, if there's a need for sanction or reprimand, that that will be fair and will come perhaps once the initial issue has been dealt with. I think that's really important. And again, you know, we talked earlier about sort of online, the online world, and me allowing my 10-year-old daughters to have much more access to the online world than I might have generally felt comfortable with in the past has been, you know, I've gone on quite a journey with that personally. But the one thing I've known is that actually we have got a great relationship. And if anything goes in any way wrong or they're uncertain, the first thing they will do is come and talk to me. And I think, you know, I'm really lucky to have that kind of relationship with my children. And I think it's the thing that I think is more important than getting it right, is knowing that if things do go wrong, that your children will come to you.
That's right. And what the image, you know, I'm coming back to that word of anchoring, anchor, that families should be anchors, shouldn't they? Bedrocks where, you know, where of children's values, and children know where they are. They know where they stand. They know who they can speak to. They know who they can trust. And ideally. And I think that it's, you know, whatever else goes on above ground, you know, I think that they need us to be stable and steady and consistent in our approach.
Absolutely. And I think that being consistent, children knowing where they stand, but also knowing that we will listen to their point of view, really matters. And that's something that we work hard at as a family. So we've had quite a tricky time during lockdown. My husband and I have been very, very busy with work, and we haven't given our children the amount of time that we'd like to. And we feel quite guilty about that because they're around all the time, but we've just not been able to dedicate our time to them. However, what we have done is carved out bits of time each day. So meal times in particular are really important. And then we have other little bits of golden time. So it might not be lots of time, but it's time that we specifically spend together, and that they know during those times that they can talk to us and that their opinions do matter. And mealtimes in particular it's been really interesting because we've had lots more meals together because we're all around. And seeing my girls begin to really express their opinions and their thoughts of view around the dinner table, and them knowing that their conversational input is as valid as mine or their dad's or their granny's, is really nice actually. And that's it. And I think, yeah, just providing a place where we can play with our thoughts in a safe way. And yeah, and pick them up together and question each other, I suppose, because it is safe at home. You can explore almost any topic, and then you work out, well, which bits of that do I take out into the wider world and which bits need to stay here at home, maybe.
That's right. I mean, it's you know, it's laid out in the literature that children who come from that kind of culture at home, where their little voice is able to be expressed, and sometimes they get it wrong or right, or they say something that they regret, but it's all done within the safety of family life. And I think that it is actually those children, as the research shows, who will put their hands up in class because they've practiced their little voice. They felt part of a sort of a democracy within family life, and that really feeds into their academic skills.
Absolutely. And the children that kind of break my heart in my work are not the ones who people might think I'm most worried about. So I do lots of work with kind of our more vulnerable children or those with special or additional needs. And the ones that kind of essentially cross my desk are generally ones who've got some sort of issue or label that we might ascribe to them. But the children that really worry me and who are kind of really taxing me right now are the quiet ones, those ones who skirt by under the radar, who perhaps don't get a lot of interaction. And often those are children who might not get lots of interaction at home and then don't get lots of interaction at school. And I've had experiences in the past where I've sat down with young people and sort of wanted to learn a bit about them as part of some project or another, when that young person, there's one girl in particular that really springs to mind, and just said, that's the first time anyone's really stopped and listened to me for ages. And I kind of thought, oh, she's being a bit melodramatic, as you do with teenagers. And I kind of picked it apart with her. And it genuinely seemed that she'd not really had any meaningful interaction with really anyone for days, because she didn't have a big group of friends around her. And she wasn't kind of someone who put her hand up in class, and her parents were very busy, and it seemed she had a very, very quiet life, and that someone just stopping and listening to her for a few minutes meant quite a lot to her.
And equally, you know, giving each, I mean, there's a beautiful quotation from the attachment researcher Andrea Oskis, which I always use in my talks. And she says, when a child has your attention, even for a little brief moment of time, you know, they internally, subconsciously absorb the fact, I am worth spending time with. And actually, you know, parents, I'm sure you've experienced the same as me. They're very interested in children's self-esteem. But self-esteem lives in those moments, doesn't it? That's where children's self-esteem is really given a beautiful natural boost, when we give them our time and attention.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the things I always advise parents and carers is that, in particular, if your child is spending a lot of time doing something that you just don't get, often it will be that they're obsessed with a particular YouTube channel, or there's a game that they seem to want to waste all the hours of the day on. And you kind of talk about this and everyone will nod going, we've got that in our house. And then the challenge I always say is, just can you go home and invite your child to invite you into their world just for a moment, and ask them to explain to you, what is it they actually like about this? Let them show it to you. And then suddenly you've got this kind of common language, and you might not like it and get it and really understand it, but the fact that you've taken time just to say, do you know what, instead of just dismissing yet again this thing that really matters to you, I'm going to stop and I'm going to ask you about it, even just for 5 minutes, it really does matter. And when children feel kind of seen and heard in that way, it makes a lot of difference. And I think it's one of the most reassuring things that you can know as a parent, really, because we are all often very busy. It's not about the amount of time that you give to your children, it's about the quality of that time.
And sometimes it's just about asking them. You know, one of the things that I really remember from my childhood is just my father asking, was I okay? Is there anything I needed? Is there anything I wanted to talk about? And sometimes the answer was no. But it really matters that parents ask those questions and care.
Absolutely. And I think if you know, as we return to school and we get into a bit more of a routine with our days again, then thinking about, you know, is there a moment in the day, in the week, when your child can know that they would definitely have your undivided attention? Because for me in my house, it's that little bit just before bed. And my husband and I split the bedtimes, and one puts one child to bed and the other one puts the other child to bed. And that's always the moment when, if there's anything difficult going on for either child, they will bring it up in that moment, because they know they've got our undivided attention. We don't have to rush off anywhere else then. And that is a moment they can bring things up. And I think you can build those moments in at any time. It might be during your walk or your commute to school, or it might be, getting things ready for a meal in the evening, or whatever it might be. It's about finding a moment in your day when you could just get in the habit of listening to your child. And most days there won't be anything. And sometimes there'll be little things that seem unimportant to you, but we've always got to remember that the little things are the big things for the children. And then one day maybe they do have something when they really do need your help, and they will know that you will listen, and this is a time when they can talk to you about it.
One of the other things that I absolutely love is watching how children adore giving parents advice when they're asked for it. So it's not just about us listening. Sometimes children need an opportunity to be the one who knows stuff, or to help us with our tech, or to be the one who has the solution to the problem. And I find it so interesting how good it feels for children to be in that position.
Absolutely. And actually, as a parent, isn't it brilliant when you see what a capable little person you've grown when they are able to help you enthusiastically and well with something? I love it. I love it when my kids teach me things. And you're right, they thrive on those moments. They adore it.
So it is a kind of reciprocal process, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And it's one of the things I'm finding as my own children get bigger. I enjoy them more and more, and I love that they're really forthright in their opinions, and that they question what we're thinking, and that they are becoming more adept at lots of things that I'm not so good with. So I have been being taught how to use an Apple Pencil by my 10-year-old daughter. And, you know, these kind of things, as you say, they're very au fait with this stuff, and we're just not. There's another thing that I picked up recently. So I've been using Zoom loads, as I think everyone spends their whole life on Zoom at the moment, don't they? But I hadn't learned some of the little tips and tricks and shortcuts, which when my daughter came in and was kind of watching me on Zoom, she went, well, why don't you use the space bar to unmute yourself? Or why don't you do this? And I'm like, I didn't know, this is like magic. And yeah, she loved it.
Well, my 13-year-old, who was watching me do lots of online talks, you know, he said, Mommy, why are you not using, he saw me kind of recording a talk and he said, why are you not using the, you know, the audio recording function on PowerPoint? So it was so embarrassing that I realized I could record a whole talk, you know, via PowerPoint. And he was coming up with all these solutions. You know, their confidence in technology is inspirational, isn't it?
And oh, another, absolutely.
Another lovely moment was when I was about to do quite a big talk online, you know, during lockdown, and I looked a bit nervous, and he said, oh, for goodness sake, Mommy, you've done it. How many times have you done it already? How many times have you given this talk? So giving me back the advice that I give others, you know, so we've got a lot to learn from them, don't we?
Oh, absolutely. And how comfortable they feel online as well. So Lyra, one of my daughters, came in. So she's quite good at looking at my diary and knowing when I should be finishing things. And I'd been giving a talk at a conference that had overrun. And she came into the room just as they were doing the kind of summing up. And this was an event all about school avoidance. And Lyra basically said to me, I think you should let me sum up instead of you. And I was like, well, I'll check that's okay, but I don't see why not, because she'd been through this process and was, you know, has returned to school having really struggled with attending, and so she did, and she only spoke for a couple of minutes, but she gave really, really good, sound, solid advice and was completely unfazed, because, you know, although there were a couple of hundred people in the room, she was just doing what she does every day, just chatting to a camera online, and, you know, wasn't thoughtful at all about how many people were there. And I said to her afterwards, I said, if I'd have taken you with me, if that event had run as it was originally intended to, would you have come on stage and spoken to all these people? Said, oh, no way.
And on that topic, I know we're a little bit short of time. We've been speaking for 47 minutes, but I want to ask you about school refusal and sort of school avoidance. And I know that school refusal is a term that you don't potentially like. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
So school refusal, yeah, I have difficulty with the term because it's so judgy and it suggests that a child is refusing. You know, it suggests that this is a choice that they are making. It's a bit like in the old days, people used to talk about deliberate self-harm, as if, you know, a child is sitting there and calculating, I'm going to hurt myself. And we know it's a lot more complicated than that. And I think, yeah, there's just a lot of negativity that surrounds that idea. And I think that people kind of mistake the kind of anxiety-based avoidance with truanting, and the two are very, very different. And so there's lots of issues there. And yeah, I do take issue with the term. We tend to use emotionally based school avoidance now. The difficulty is, and why I tend to use, you know, school refusal in brackets, is just because school refusal is the term that everybody knows. And so if you start trying to talk about emotionally based school avoidance, not everyone's on the same page with you yet. And that's a bit of an issue. But as the parent of a previous school refuser, in inverted commas, it wasn't like that for her at all. And you know, so many parents I've spoken to and so many young people I've spoken to who've been through this, it's not about refusing to go. It's about absolutely not being able to on those days, just physically not being able to do it. When you're so distressed that the thought of school means you physically can't get yourself out of bed in the morning and you're in floods of tears or having that big, you know, physiological anxious response. That's not about refusal. It's can't.
Certainly not something that requires a kind of discipline. It requires empathy, surely.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing here is not just empathy with the child, but empathy with the whole family. It's really tough for everybody involved. And one of the things that schools get really wrong here, and it is changing, I just have to say that in defense of schools, it is changing. But one of the things that can go wrong here is that schools will sometimes be kind of chasing parents, and they might get the legal letter saying, you know, your child isn't attending, and that it all becomes quite difficult quite quickly. And the parent can feel quite judged and unsupported when they're probably trying their absolute hardest to get their child in. And when your child is so, so, so worried about attending school, it's very, very difficult. And it wears you down as a parent. You know, I had days where by the time I got Lyra across the threshold at school, we'd probably been battling in some way or another for about 3 or 4 hours. And I was just totally broken as a parent. And I didn't need anyone's judgment or their questioning. What I needed was a hug and a cup of tea.
And also you're going to be feeling terribly anxious during the school day and unable to focus because you're worried about how she's getting on.
Absolutely, 100% that. And it's And it's horrible, you know, if you have managed by hook or by crook to manage to get your child into school when it's something they're really struggling with and they really don't want to be there, then you feel like the most horrible parent ever. Because, well, you know, it just feels like the wrong thing to do. It feels so distressing for you. You feel like you're hurting them. It's, yeah, really, really hard.
And I remember a very distressing phone call I've had from a parent whose little boy just ran out of school. He ran and he ran and he ran, you know, and he wasn't being naughty. He was so anxious. But actually, the school didn't handle it well. They were disciplining him. They were sort of the parent, and the parent had no support or help. In that scenario, what are the three best tips you would give the school or the teacher, and the three best tips for the parent?
Oh, great question. I think I'd flip it, actually, and I'd think about it all from the point of view of the child, if that's okay, just because I try and take a child-centered approach as I can in all things. And the thing with school-based anxiety is it's really complicated. There's no one-size-fits-all. And the most important thing that we need to do is to understand it from the point of view of the child and know what's going on for them and why this feels so hard. And they might not be able to tell us that right away, but we're certainly not going to find out by guessing or failing to listen. So if we're trying to encourage a child back to school or to engage in some way with school, then the first thing I would look at is, what does the child want? What might be a motivation for them to return? And parents and the school can help think about this too. But what would make them want to attend? It might be something that doesn't make sense to us or that seems really small. It might be that there's a particular extracurricular activity they enjoy, or one friend that they really like, or one part of the school where they feel really safe, or that they like the school dog, or whatever it might be. We find that tiny, tiny hook, and we use that as a kind of a motivation, a carrot, if you like, for the child going in. The next thing is about the child needing to feel like they belong, so that they're wanted. So when they do arrive at school, that they're welcomed, you know, with open arms, and we're delighted, whatever time it is, and whether they've come in the right uniform, whatever. If they have managed to make it to school, making sure that they are received really, really warmly, and that they know that they belong here and that they are part of this community, and the parents and carers too, they need to feel kind of embraced by the school when they arrive. Because, you know, if you've made a huge effort to get in and then you're met with, well, you're late, or now you're in detention, or whatever, I mean, you're not going to make the effort again, or it's going to be even more difficult the next time. And then the final thing is thinking with the child about, what can they do? So building up a series of I cans, if you like. So what will often happen is, for children who are struggling to attend or have got other issues going on at school, then we begin to see all the things that they can't do. So we see, you know, the lack of attendance, or that their grades are going down, or that their behaviour's been poor, or all these other really negative things. And the child begins to see themselves through those lenses that the adults are painting of them, of all these things that are wrong. And what we need to do is to hunt really, really hard and find what is good here, and use that as a starting point and begin to build it up. So you might have a child who hasn't been to school for many months, and there'll be some children who are looking to return in the autumn who hadn't been attending for some time prior to lockdown. And the idea of going back might be really scary. And so we might think, well, maybe the idea of going to school might be setting us up for failure if we're trying to do it all at once. But what can this child do? And we might talk to them, and we might decide, well, I can, as a starting point, I can sit in my room with my school sweater on. And that's the starting point. Once I've decided I can do that, let's build on it. What next? What might I be able to do next? Maybe I can sit and do some work in my own home environment for half an hour, or I can meet my teacher in a neutral place and not talk about school, but just be in the room with her for 10 minutes, you know, little things that they find they can do. So yeah, I want. So the motivation for going to school, I'm wanted, feeling welcome when I get there, and I can. What can I do?
What do you say to parents? I've met many of them who have commented that their child is quite clearly thriving more at home and less anxious than they would normally be in the school environment, and that they're quite keen not to sort of disrupt the progress that they feel they've made.
It's a really good question. And I've spoken to many families in that kind of situation as well, and particularly children who were previously anxious about school, or many autistic children, actually, who've really thrived at home when they might have found school to be quite a struggle. What I'd say here is first of all, just taking a step right back and thinking about what are our motivations for sending the child to school? Why do they want to be there? And why do I want them to be there? And does it still make sense? Because it, you know, some families might choose actually to do something different moving forward. They might find that there are different ways of doing things for them. But then the other thing I would do is to stop and think about, why is it working well at home? What's gone well here? And how can we share some of what we've learned with the school? Because they will be really keen to replicate what you've done so well at home at school for your child. And having those conversations early and thinking about, you know, what circumstances this child really thrives in and how the school might be able to replicate that will make a big difference. I think the other thing to remember here is that when we've really built our children up and they've got to a place of feeling quite kind of calm and happy and they're thriving at home, that does mean that they're in a really strong position actually to begin to try and do the scarier thing of engaging with school again, and that they're in a much better place perhaps to give it a good go than they might have been when they were really run down and physically and emotionally exhausted prior to lockdown.
Yeah, that's a really, really good positive piece of advice. Thank you. I think one of the things I'm always struck by is that, you know, schools really need to have audited how young people are feeling before September, because they'll be able to work out who's feeling like this from asking parents or asking pupils themselves. So they can do a lot of early work. I love that idea of early conversations to sort of preempt having great difficulties with children returning in September.
Absolutely. And I think that this groundwork that many schools are doing and have done in the run up to the return is really important. And also just thinking about what that transition back into normal school kind of looks like. And many of them are planning kind of softer, more nurturing landings in September. So kind of extending that transition period, really. But yes, it does really matter. And I think we can't make any assumptions about who are the children who will have thrived and who are the ones who will be struggling, because it may have changed dramatically during this time. Many schools that I'm working with have reported that those children who used to be kind of, you know, on their list of red, you know, on their RAG rating because they needed more input and support, many of them have done brilliantly during lockdown and really looking forward to coming back to school, and that perhaps their level of need will have decreased significantly during the time. Whereas there are others who were perhaps fine when they were in school, but their whole sense of belonging and purpose was completely taken away from them. You know, our really gregarious kids who are really academic and do really well in sports and all those things, and their whole life is based on school and how great everything is there for them. When that's all taken away, these are the kind of kids who have perhaps been more likely to become kind of low or anxious and might be really worried about the return and find that more difficult. So they might have been the ones who you'd never think twice about before lockdown, who were just living it, you know, they're absolutely brilliant, who might now be not quite themselves and just need a little bit more TLC to get back to themselves again.
Equally, children are very good, in my experience, at evaluating how they're feeling, or if they need help, they can be quite clear cut about whether they need help or more support than not.
Absolutely. You know, I think we are raising the most amazingly emotionally literate generation. And I am blown away again and again and again by the ability of our children and young people to tell us how they're feeling, and to do that in some quite creative and imaginative ways. And they are very, very good now. And they're not shy like maybe they might have been in previous generations. They're generally not shy about asking for help for themselves or others. The problems come when they don't know where they can go for that help, or if there isn't anywhere that they can go for that help. So just thinking really carefully about what are the avenues for support here, and how do children know that they will be heard if they try to access them is really important.
And I think that's a beautiful question for schools to kind of lead with. You know, do children know that they'll be heard, and do they know where they can go for help? Because I've encountered so many children who on the surface seem well supported, but they wouldn't really know who they could talk to about a particular problem. And that's disappointing. I think children need a sort of almost a physical aid memoir to remind them of a little map of who they can go to for different issues and problems.
I completely agree. And the thing that goes wrong here often is not that those things aren't in place, you know, that there aren't good sources of support, but rather that we just haven't communicated them well. And the thing I always try to remind schools is this is not about what the actual situation is. It's about the child's perception of the situation. So if their perception is there's no one I can go to for help, even if there are loads of different places that they could go, actually the reality is they're not going to get that help when needed. So we need to think about what help is there and how can we effectively communicate that with children and their families so that if help is needed, it will be sought as necessary.
On this particular point of what you've termed the emotionally based school avoidance, I know that you have a course that educators can attend. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, so we have been busy during lockdown, creating lots and lots of online learning. And we do have an on-demand training course about breaking the cycle of emotionally based school avoidance or school refusal. And I do also have some live webinars coming up on it. So I don't know exactly when this will end up airing, but they kind of come round relatively regularly. And certainly I can give you links to the website and things so people can see what's coming up and what might be helpful to them.
And Pookie, do mention your website now, because it will be we'll be able to write it up in our notes, etc. So any useful websites, please mention them.
Sure. So all of our online training is, we're Creative Education, and currently that's sitting at elearning.creativeeducation.co.uk. But another place that's really worth following is my YouTube channel, which is all completely free. And there's all sorts of different things that are coming through there. And that's just youtube.com/PookieH. And then the final thing that might be of interest would be my podcast. I'm guessing people listening to podcasts like podcasts. So I have a podcast which you'll find if you search for Pookie Ponders, or you can go to PookieH.buzzsprout.com.
Lovely. Well, thank you so much. You and I could sit here and talk for 3 hours probably, but I'm
easily
taking up an hour of your time. So thank you so much, Pookie. I love speaking to you and I love interacting with you and I love everything that you do online. So thanks again and very best of luck to your lovely girls when they return to school.
Thank you. And thank you ever so much for having me. And thank you too, Kathy, for all the work that you do. As you know, I recommend your work all the time and I'm a massive fan. So it's a real privilege to talk to you today.
Thank you so much. Take good care. Bye-bye, Pookie.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Get a Grip podcast. Just as a reminder, there are notes that you can actually download following each interview available on my website.